When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top-brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Welcome to the BBC Music Magazine podcast. You can subscribe to the magazine by visiting classical-music.com or to our interactive iPad edition by visiting itunes.com. BBC Music Magazine is now an official Apple Music curator, and you can listen to our exclusive playlists by visiting applemusic.com/BBCMM. So hello, I'm Oliver Condy, editor of BBC Music Magazine, and here we are all once again, this time with a slightly revamped version of our First Listen podcast. In previous months, all four of us have discussed just one intriguing new disc between us, but from this month, we'll each be choosing a recording that has caught our ears with the aim of trying to pique the interest of our colleagues. With me in the studio this week to share their discoveries are Deputy Editor Jeremy Pound, Reviews Editor Rebecca Franks, and Editorial Assistant Eleanor Cooper.
Hello. Hello.
So let's get on with the show. Rebecca, which recording have you chosen to bring today?
I have chosen a disc called Monteverdi's The Other Vespers, and that's with Ifagellini and Robert Hollingworth. And as we probably know, it's Monteverdi's 450th anniversary year this year. I, for one, have been slightly addicted to his music and having a bit of a Monteverdi obsession. And there's been a lot in the concert hall. There's John Elliott Gardiner doing his fantastic opera series. And there haven't actually been so many recordings yet, but there have been a handful that have come through. But this one really captured my imagination. So let's have a listen to one of the tracks from the disc, which is Monteverdi's Beata's Veer. Was Monteverdi's Beata's Veer from this disc of Monteverdi's The Other Vespers. Just had a little amusing exchange. I've written down that I liked the kind of level of bounce on that. I thought it was quite uplifting.
And I thought it didn't have enough bounce. I think usually recordings of that do tend to be a bit kind of livelier, maybe even a bit faster. But it's lovely. I think it's really elegant and, really nice singing.
I wonder if there are some decisions, actually, performance or practice decisions that Robert Hollingworth writes about in the booklet notes, which they're really good booklet notes, actually, as well. I thought they were really nice and kind of straightforward and explained just the right things about what they were doing. But he talks a bit about his tempo decisions in there. So I wonder if it's kind of based on that, perhaps.
Can you just give us a further idea of what's in the programme other than Monteverdi? Because there's other composers, aren't there?
So he's taken the idea that Monteverdi, the Vespers of 1610, has become this, it's actually a collection, but has sort of become this big iconic works, all performed together. You can probably hear it all over the place this year. And he has actually said, right, We don't actually know that that was all performed together. We don't know that Monteverdi would ever have performed it, been sort of involved in performances. There are no records of this. But we do have the documents of Monteverdi directing the music for a Vespers, not at St. Mark's Basilica in Venice, but elsewhere for a different feast in 1620. And they've used a later collection of his music published in 1641, the Selva Morale Spirituale, which is the moral and spiritual wood, to put together this kind of alternative Vespers. And it has other composers. So it has some instrumental stuff by Castello and Frescobaldi. It has a bit of Palestrina in a sort of arrangement, and a piece by Donati and some Giovanni Gabrielli. So it has other pieces interwoven.
I kind of wish that was made more obvious on the cover of the CD, actually, because you do get the impression that this is perhaps a Vespers, a collection of Monteverdi works formed into a Vespers that people don't know, rather than simply being a collection of Monteverdi works and other composers. And although I love it, I think it's a wonderful conceit. I love the organ music. I mean, myself being an organist, it's always nice to hear organ music in a disc that is on a popular label like Decca Classics. And I think the instrument they've chosen is fantastic. It's a very beautiful, lovely sort of woody chamber organ. And I think it is delightful, but I would have liked there to have been a little bit more explicit description of what we're getting.
There's a nice resonant acoustic to the recording as well, actually, I have to say. I'm a bit fed up with some of these dry, acoustically recorded period instrument recordings we get these days. To actually let it breathe a little bit is rather nice.
And the ensemble size is nice.
It's nice,
isn't it? It's nice and intimate, actually.
And there's a nice sense of improvisation as well. I think that they do really well with the instrumentalists. That kind of brings it alive.
I'm going to hear another track.
Yes. So, in fact, this one kind of demonstrates that a bit. So this is the Ave Verum Corpus. It's Palestrina, but in this kind of embellished version by Giovanni Battista Bovicelli, and you'll hear kind of male voices and then a cornetto kind of improvise, well, sort of playing over the top, sort of elaborations. It's quite haunting, I thought. Well, we all think that that reminds us of Jan Garbarek with improvising the saxophone over the voices of the Iliad Ensemble, but some of us like that more than others.
Well, I think it just goes to show that there's nothing new under the sun, really, doesn't it, really? I mean, you know,
that's
Jan Garbarek and the Iliad Ensemble weren't exactly groundbreaking, although what they did was sort of reintroduce that in a modern context, but that clearly is improvisatory.
Yeah.
All music of this period was improvisatory, you know. Instrumental music was.
I think it's rather effective.
So that was Monteverdi, the other Vespers, performed by E. Fagiolini, conducted by Robert Hollingworth, and that's on Decca Classics. And that's Rebecca's choice this month. Now we're going to move on to Eleanor Cooper's choice, and you've chosen Brahms sonatas for cello and piano and Schumann five pieces performed by Robin Michael on the cello and Daniel Tong on piano. Tell us why you've chosen this.
So this was actually, I reviewed this in the July issue of BBC Music Magazine for our brief notes section, and I was just so struck by it that I thought I'd include it here again, because its unique selling point really is that it's a historical performance, which I don't think we tend to associate with Brahms so much, and Schumann to an extent. But so there's a really interesting programme note that explains why they've decided to do that. And Robin Michael, who is the cellist on this, he's playing with gut strings. And Daniel Tong is actually playing a piano that they think Brahms played. So it's contemporary piano for Brahms. And it gives us this really intimate kind of chamber feel to Brahms's music, which is often played with very big, kind of lush, full vibrato-y sound, and it's just really nice and new, and I really enjoyed it. So I would start with by playing a track. So this is the track from Brahms's Sonata Number 1 for cello and piano in E minor, and it's the Allegro non troppo. Thank you. So that was the Sonata number 1 for cello and piano in E minor. And that's one of two sonatas on this disc. It's 1 and 2. And then Schumann's 5 pieces in a fugue style.
I really love the balance, actually, on this disc. I think when Daniel Tong is really going for it, I don't get the impression that he would swamp out the cello. I think the engineers don't necessarily have to do much for the ensemble. I think the two instruments are married well together.
Yeah, it's really interesting because Michael says that he never really got Brahms, and then he played it with John Elliott Gardiner, actually, and had kind of that influence from John Elliott Gardiner, who's a historical legend.
Because he's principal cello of the Orchestra Revolutionaire, isn't
he? And he was saying that that approach was the first time that he really understood how Brahms's music could sit in a chamber capacity, particularly because it's not really, his vision of it is that it's not really that big. It's very intimate.
I think you definitely get the intimacy there, don't you, in that opening with just the focus on the cello line. Sure. I found this interesting because for an upcoming issue of the magazine where we're actually looking at the influence of period instruments on performers and pieces of music and the kind of match between them, I was talking to a clarinetist, actually, about Brahms, and they were saying the instrument completely made them rethink how to approach this music. And as you say, there's kind of been this tradition later of turning it into this big romantic kind of feel. But actually, there could be more elements of speech or something about the instruments that you use will kind of dictate how you phrase and how you colour the sound. And I get that impression that that's what's happened here as well.
I do like the simplicity and the intimacy of it, but do you occasionally feel that they're keeping their emotions a little bit too much in check?
I don't know. I think the instrument, which is a Blüthner, as far as I can tell, is a very intimate piano. And it depends what you mean by keeping your emotions in check. I mean, I think our ears are more attuned to the idea of grand sort of dynamic changes being symbolic of sort of great mood changes. And I think that can be done as much with the articulation and with the movement of the music as much as it can be done with the movement of the volume of the instrument.
I suppose there's a danger as well in going, oh, we know that Brahms had this piano and might have played it. Then that gives it more authenticity than, I mean, perhaps that's just convenience. Perhaps that was the piano that was there.
I guess,
and actually, you might want something else.
I guess actually, it's one of these occasions where you've actually got to train yourself as a listener a bit, because I'm so used to hearing the Brahms sonatas with kind of a Steinway piano, a modern cello, or a big cello, and both going hell for leather.
And that works too.
And that works too. And you get so used to that sort of sound world that when you hear it played differently and on different types of instruments.
And I think it's really important to know that Brahms, realise that Brahms looks back as much as he looks forward. I mean, Brahms was really a Bach fan, and also how much of a sort of classical heritage there is in this. And this intimacy, I think, reminds us of the music that comes before Brahms as much as the music that was being written at the same time and maybe stuff a little bit after, like Elgar, for example. Mm. You know.
The second track I've chosen actually to play you is a bit bigger and a bit kind of more outward-looking, so maybe we should listen to that now. It's from the Schumann 5 Pieces in a Fugue style, and it's Nicht zu rasch. That was a piece from Schumann's 5 Pieces in a Fugue style, Nicht zu rasch.
We were talking about actually how maybe the balance isn't quite as good here, but maybe that's because Schumann isn't as great at writing for cello and piano as Brahms. I don't know. Did Brahms have a much better understanding of the kind of relationship those two instruments have? I don't know.
I mean, they are folk songs, so there is that kind of simpler, the cello is supposed to be leading more and being the singer.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas the piano is maybe accompanying, whereas in the Brahms it really feels like they're partners and they're kind of have this relationship that changes throughout it.
So Eleanor was talking about recording on the Resonus label, which is Brahms' Sonatas for Cello and Piano, Opuses 38 and 39, and Schumann's 5 Pieces in a Fugue style, Opus 102, with Robin Michael on cello and Daniel Tong on piano. So that's my turn. And I'm going for the new Aura Disc. It's a brand new choir. Well, it was founded in February 2016. Brand new choir. Founded by the vocal conductor, the choral conductor, Susie Digby, made up of singers from choirs all across London, I suppose. Sort of choral spotters will no doubt see singers that have come from the 16 or the Gabrielli Consort or other choirs. But this is sort of the best of the best. This is how she describes the creme de la creme of the choral talent today. And, well, her projects are very, very original. This is volume two we're discussing today of Renaissance gems and their reflections. And the idea is that the discs are collections of Renaissance music, and composers are invited to compose reactions to these pieces. The best thing to do, I think, is to play some of the Talis that is featured on this disc, just to give you an idea of the singing quality. So the first track is Thomas Talis's Videte Miraculum, Behold the Miracle. So that was an extract from Thomas Talis's Videte Miraculum, Behold the Miracle, sung by Aura, a new choir conducted by Susie Digby. I think the singing is sublime. I think the balance of voices are lovely. And what I like about it is the fact that there seems to be a nice sort of modern take on it without it being too kind of stuffy, but also without it going the other way, without it being too kind of, you know, over the top. I think there's a sense of sensible dynamic levels, but an emotional intelligence to it.
I think what's really nice is you can hear the characters of the individual voices, even though it's within that kind of framework of the choir. And there are some fantastic singers, as you said, on that disc. And it's really lovely to hear that kind of individual sound, which you don't hear in other choirs always.
How many voices are there in the choir?
I think it varies from recording to recording, but I think on this one there are exactly 20.
And are they evenly spread, or...?
I think there are 8 sopranos and then 4 altos, 4 tenors and 4 basses. I think the balance is actually really rather lovely. I think having 8 sopranos means you get a very clean upper line and you get this beautiful texture underlying it. I think it works very well. Mm-hmm. Of course, the main meat, I think, of this recording and their previous recordings has been their commissions. And they've got a very, very ambitious goal in 10 years to have 100 commissions by 100 contemporary composers. Mm-hmm. I think Susie and her board have been busy scrabbling around trying to find some private sponsorship to actually fund this, but it's a very impressive aim. All of those composers, female, male, young and old, are to be given a piece of Renaissance music and a length of time in which they're to write that piece within. But on the whole, they're free in what they can do with that piece of music. And what we've come up with is a set of very valuable pieces that can be part of this sort of rich choral heritage that we have in this country and, of course, in other countries around the world. And I think Susie is, again, you know, trying to create a sort of a new golden age, is what she says, of choral singing. It's a very laudable project. I think we should hear certainly one of my favourites, which is Richard Allain's reaction to the Talis piece we heard earlier. So it's his version of Videte Miraculum. So we'll hear a short extract of that just to give you a flavour of the sort of thing these composers are doing.
Thank you.
So that was Richard Alleyne's Videte Miraculum, a very sort of multi-layered sound, sort of with a sort of cantus firmus sort of underlying, I think, foundation to it. I do get the impression sometimes that a lot of the commission pieces are of that sort of ilk.
I quite like about this disc is there is at least enough variety within the various commissions. And let's be honest, they are actually all going from the same kind of same base. So there's only so far you can escape that original brief.
I suppose, but I suppose I felt that sometimes I would like a bit more polyphony rather than that sort of sense of clustery nebulousness that you get in modern choral music, which, as we all know, is sort of born out of that sort of Lauridsen, Whitkerb style that's
very
been
invoked,
around for 10, 20 years.
Yeah. I had a mini gripe, which was not to do with the actual musical content, but just that they've got six commissions here and there's only one by a female composer. So I just, it'd be really nice if they have a more of a balance in their upcoming ones, which they may well do. I don't know what they've got coming up in the projects, but that seems quite strange when there are so many contemporary female composers. And it's just something I notice on quite a few choral discs coming through that I always wonder why that is the case. I understand historically might be more difficult, but with contemporary stuff where you're choosing your composers,
I have a
question about that, really.
I don't have a quote so much from that. I'm sure that balance will be kind of balanced out as we go through the series. At least I hope it will. My gripe is actually with one tiny moment of performance in what is such a beautifully sung disc overall. In Ken Burton's piece, the tenor soloist seems very out of sorts. I'm slightly surprised that they let that one go.
I think it's a stylistic thing. I can hear what they may have been trying to do with that, but I agree with you. I'm not sure it was successful, but I think that it's in the style.
Yes, but they're singing in a certain style and they're sounding downright uncomfortable, which frankly he does.
Maybe they should have chosen a gospel singer or someone more attuned to that kind of style of singing. But I think a lot of these singers aren't necessarily soloists. I think they are very much, you know, ensemble members. I think they go to create a blend and a type of sound that obviously Susie Digby is after. Mm. Whether they are sort of full blown soloists, I don't know.
I should add that that's just a tiny little moment in what is altogether beautifully sung.
It's very beautifully sung.
It is, and it was very moving actually to see the Stephen Stuckey. Although Stephen Stuckey wasn't commissioned to write a piece for this disc, he died while they were recording the disc in the same month. So as a sort of tribute to him, they included his O Sacrum Convivium. It's a very sort of, and they put this right at the front as the first new contemporary piece within the collection. It works very, very well.
Mm, absolutely. It's really a beautiful piece. Mm. Another one which I wanted to pick out was actually the female composer on the disc, who's Kerry Andrew, who's written this piece, which is not in her style that I've heard otherwise, and she's kind of very well known for doing body percussion and kind of very modern looped vocal works. And actually, she's written something like that for the BBC 10 Pieces project, which is coming up this summer. And so it's really nice to hear her kind of exploring a different sound.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was Aura's new disc, Many Are the Wonders, it's called, and it's volume 2 in their collection of Renaissance Gems and Their Reflections, and it's conducted by Susan Digby, and it's on the Harmonia Mundi label. So now we move on to Deputy Editor Jeremy's Choice. What have you brought in for us to enjoy today?
Right, you're not going to hear that many discs over the course of the year, which have been recorded by a recorder quartet. But this one came to my attention fairly recently, and I absolutely adore it. The name of the quartet in question is called Palisander, and the disc is called Beware the Spider. And what it is, basically, it is a disc of works which are related to spiders and, more importantly, to spider bites. And part of the historical thing of this is that in the distant past, when you were bitten by a spider, it was believed that one of the best ways to get rid of the poison was to dance vigorously. And so a number of these words, and this is actually where I'll explain this after we've heard our first track, but we sort of get tarantella from this. But first of all, I actually want to play one of the tracks, and that track is it's by Vivaldi, and it's called The Nightmare Concerto. Now, this was originally a flute concerto, which has actually been arranged by one of the group's members, Miriam Nervell, for recorder quartet. And we're going to hear the final movement, which is the Allegro. And the idea behind The Nightmare Concerto is that when you are bitten by a spider, it gives you all sorts of hallucinogenic, horrible dreams. And this is what Vivaldi is portraying here. Thank you. Right, before we actually go on to all matters arachnophobic, I just wanted to briefly describe what a tarantella is and its sort of etymology. So it's all quite complex because there's these... it is actually, the word tarantella is derived not from tarantula, but actually from the town Taranto in southern Italy. And also, the word tarantula actually probably, we think, is also derived from Taranto. So that's where this sort of, these three words all come together. And it was in Taranto that people kind of danced these dances to actually try and sweat sort of spider poison out of their blood. And hence you get these sort of slightly manic dances, which have been beautifully arranged here, I have to say.
Maybe I should have tried that when I got stung by a jellyfish last week. Should have done a crazy dance to get rid of this.
Well, maybe you could persuade Palisander to do another disc called Beware of the Jellyfish, yeah. Just for people like yourself.
But they've actually arranged a lot of this music, haven't they, for a quartet? I mean, they've been very, very sort of resourceful, I think. They've dug up all sorts of wonderful bits and pieces, and they've put together a programme that is very coherent and is very, very, you know, it's a very arresting.
It's very interesting as well when you read about it. I mean, to listen to, but also just to read about it as well.
And absolutely, just to give you a range of the composers here, as well as that Vivaldi. We've got sort of some Bird in there. I've never heard of this chap before, but... Athanasios Kircher, who dates from 1641. And then there's a couple of just traditional Neapolitan tarantellas in there as well. And so it shows that sort of this kind of whole fear of spiders and this belief that somehow you can use non-medical ways of actually getting rid of spider poison. It spread right across Europe. It wasn't just an Italian thing.
But it was to do with the humours, wasn't it? So it was kind of the tarantula bite affected your humour that you were in. And so music has always had a really close relationship with humours and making you feel a certain way. And I like on this disc that they've included some of the karma things as well, because there were different kinds of tarantula bite that you had. And so some of them would make you melancholy and some of them would make you have fits. And then there's this calming music as well, which is used for potentially for the people who are having fits.
And anyone who's arachnophobic is not actually a tarantula. And there's a spider on the front, so you'd want to know about that on the cover. But actually the spider isn't a tarantula that we think of. It's probably a black widow spider.
Exactly.
But the playing is very crisp. And I think it's very, you know, the ensemble's fantastic. And
so
the
clean. Really immaculate.
Great. And, you know, I think, you know, I mean, dare I say it, recorder ensemble is not something I would necessarily go out in here, let's all be honest. But I think this ensemble clearly showing what a multicoloured, diverse sound you can get from these instruments. I mean, that wonderful sort of panpipey effect that is it a bass recorder, tenor recorder? I don't know.
I think it must be a bass recorder.
Yeah, they've got a contrabass, I think. Because I was reading in the back, they did this 24-hour recordathon to raise money so that they could have these recorders, wow. Which is like a console, and then they've got a contrabass in F.
And they do all sorts of kind of clever tricks with them as well. They show how much you can do with a recorder rather than just blow through it. It's brilliant. Yeah. So for my next tracks now, we're going to go for one of the traditional Neapolitan tarantellas. It's just a traditional song, and it was arranged by Miriam Nerval again. There we go. I just love the folkiness of that. That was a traditional Neapolitan tarantella arranged by Miriam Nerval. And it was on this disc, which is Beware the Spider by Palisander, which is a recorder quartet. And it's on their own label. It's the Palisander label.
Marvellous. So we've come to the end of each other's recordings. So we come to the bit now where we vote on the one recording we've most enjoyed out of the selection. You're not allowed to vote for your own. So, Rebecca, let's return to you. Which recording most sort of caught your ear?
I'm actually going to vote for that Palisander because it opened my ears. Yeah, a lot of fun.
I've really enjoyed all the four recordings we've heard. I think Monteverdi is going to have quite enough promotion this year as it is anyway. So I was particularly taken with the Brahms and the Schumann.
It's such a hard choice, but of all the discs, I think the one I would return to listen to again would be the Beware the Spider, just because, again, it's just such an interesting sound that I'm not used to hearing, and I love what they've done with it.
I'm actually going to go for the Monteverdi. I thought it was just a beautifully imaginative collection of works that I would return to again and again. And I think the ensemble is fine. I think the acoustic is fine. And I think the musicianship is clearly shining through. What a brave recording to put on Decca, a label that sort of, I think, you know, has a duty as part of a multinational company to produce slightly more popular discs. So I think it's a brave choice for them. So I enjoyed that very much. So I think that actually gives us, by one vote, a winner in Palisander. So congratulations, yeah, Palisander. Woo! You are the first winner of our new First Listen podcast. So that brings us to the end of this month's podcast. I do hope we've given you some new ideas for listening. In the meantime, it's goodbye from all of us.
Goodbye. Bye.
And we'll see you next month. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to this BBC Music Magazine podcast, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at classical-music.com or simply head to iTunes.